Welcome to the Daily Apple. I'm your host, Kevin White. MRI and I will dive into all topics related to the science of longevity, along with some other subjects we find of interest, with the hopes to provide useful information for everyone. This stems from my personal interest to optimize the human condition, to not just live longer, but to live better.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Daily Apple. This is part three of our discussion with Dr. Matthew Camberlin. And I hope you're enjoying this. I really enjoyed recording it and having this conversation.
So, what's your goal for your clinic going forward? What do you hope to see Prime Health become in the next year, 2 years, 5 years?
We want to obviously expand with what we do to allow, you know, for other people. We want to expand how, you know, the data we gather. To be, you know, much more efficient, much more all-encompassing, and kind of incorporate some of these, you know, specific DNA assays and stuff, but trying to meld through what works, what doesn't, what's appropriate, what's good, and what's not, like we were talking about before.
I think this is one of the real challenges, is there's so many different tests you can do. How do you figure out, you know, which are the right tests, which are informative, which are actionable. Mm-hmm. That's a real challenge. I mean, this is sort of what we're also figuring out as part of our Trailblazer program. We're trying a lot and then asking what gives information that we think is informative and actionable. And genetics is an interesting one, right? Because we've gotten to the point now where genome sequencing is really pretty cheap. Mm-hmm. Anybody can get their genome sequenced. Mm-hmm. But what do you do with that information? And there's only a relatively small number of genes where we have variants that are what I would call, you know, large effect sizes, right? Like the BRCA1 gene for breast cancer, or APOE for dementia and heart disease. And then there's a bunch of what we call these polygenic risk analyses that can be done, where you have many, many genes that all contribute to one trait. And those, I think, are a little bit harder because we don't really know in many cases, you know, how informative that is for a person's actual risk when you get these polygenic risk scores. And of course, you know, every trait is going to be a combination of genetics and environment. And under environment, that includes diet and, you know, all of the lifestyle stuff, in addition to air quality, water quality, all of that falls under environment. So it's different for different things. And I think we're still figuring it out, you know, in-house at OptiSpan. How do we use that information? How do we tie that into the blood-based biomarkers, the DEXA, you know, ultrasound, cancer screening, and integrate that in a way that's actually useful? And biological age tests. We haven't really talked about biological age, but, you know, that's an emerging area where we have tools today that weren't available 5 years ago that supposedly can measure biological age. How do you integrate that into your, you know, health span practice? Clearly it's important, but I don't know if these tests are actually to the point where we can use them in an actionable way.
Yeah.
Do you guys do biological age testing?
No. Well, we've added it in. Yeah. We don't do it on everybody, but anybody who wants it, we get it done. Yeah. So we don't do it as a rule.
That's the epigenetic tests. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, and what'll be nice is as we make changes moving forward, rechecking them and seeing if we're able to, you know, change some of those things.
Right, right.
Like you said,
move the needle. Yeah. And again, I think that's where the biological age tests are to be determined, right? Yeah. How responsive are they to lifestyle changes? But I think also then how do you actually validate that? So let's say you've got somebody who... I mean, this is actually an interesting question, right? How would you interpret somebody? We'll go back to Dave, right? So Dave takes the epigenetic test, and then 6 months later, he takes another epigenetic test, and, you know, according to the test, he's biologically 10 years younger, but none of his other biomarkers have moved. How do you interpret that?
I would put the weight more on the biomarkers initially.
Yeah.
With him being 10 years younger on the biological age, I would scratch my head and not really put much weight on that.
Me too. I would agree with you. And that's a hypothetical, right? I mean, this is part of the problem. We don't really know with these tests yet. How often does that happen?
Yeah.
Right. So, but I would agree with you. I think for now, I much more weigh the well-established clinical biomarkers, blood chemistry, body composition, things like that, compared to these more, you know, theoretical biological age metrics.
Yeah, if somebody's prediabetes is getting worse, I don't, you know, that trumps it all. So
yeah.
So I'm going to change subjects on you here in a minute.
Go for it.
The whole aging world, interest in longevity, and I was talking about this a little bit before, is, you know, the fact that you got interested in this and switched gears at a young age. Majority of people in this space who are interested in this are late 30s, 40s, and 50s, such. But here you are in early 20s, and it's like, hey, aging is pretty cool. I'm going to get into that. What flipped the switch? What's the deal there? Because in my early 20s, I was not thinking along those lines.
Yeah, well, so I hate to disappoint you, but I might have looked like I was in my early 20s. I was actually, how old was I when I went to graduate school? So I started graduate school in 1998. I think 1998. One of those two. Yeah. I'm old. I can't remember. But I was born in 1971. So I was in my late 20s when I started graduate school. But I mean, I think the reason why I got interested in aging was total accident. So I, in my early 20s, we'll talk about this over beers. I suspect I was way worse than you were. Certainly in high school, I can almost guarantee I was worse than you were. But that's a different story. But I got interested in aging. I went to graduate school. So I got my undergraduate degree at a college not far from here, about 90 miles north of Seattle, called Western Washington University. It's a, you know, sort of smaller state school. I loved it. Absolutely love Western. Probably would have be living in Bellingham, the city that Western's in now, if they had a world-class research institution there, because I just love the city, love the university. But like I said, it was a smaller state school where I feel like I got a really good education, but they didn't really have graduate students. They didn't really, you know, it was an undergrad experience. Mm. And so I didn't even really know what graduate school was all about. Mm-hmm. I just kind of knew I liked science. I wanted to keep studying and I enjoyed my undergraduate research experience there. Mm. And so I got accepted to a bunch of places, but I ended up going to the biology program at MIT. God, you want to talk about culture shock? Go from a little state, you know, school, Western Washington University, to a high-powered MIT, and oh my God, that's another different story. But I survived my first year at MIT, and I went there thinking I was going to study biochemistry or biophysical chemistry, X-ray crystallography, something like that, protein structure, because that's what I was trained in. My undergraduate degrees were in biochemistry and mathematics. I had two bachelors. But I heard a talk during my first, it was between the first and second semesters at MIT by Lenny Gerenti, who I ended up doing my PhD with, where he gave a seminar about how his lab had started, you know, using genetics and molecular biology to study aging. Mm-hmm. And it was just something about the way he presented it, and the idea that we could actually study something as complicated as aging using these tools, right? Biochemistry, molecular biology, genetics, just stuck with me. And so I went and I talked to Lenny and ended up joining his lab and did my PhD working on the genetics of longevity and have stayed in the field since then. And I think, you know, again, at first I was enticed by the complexity of the problem. Like I recognized immediately this is really complicated. And that appealed to me. And then I also recognized very, very quickly how important it was. I mean, I've said this before, but I absolutely believe that if your goal, and this is supposed to be the goal of NIH research and biomedical research, if your goal is to improve human health, mm-hmm. there really is no biological problem more important than the biology of aging to improve human health. Every major cause of death and disability in every developed nation has age as its greatest risk factor. If you want to have an impact on human health, modifying the biology of aging is the way to go. And so I recognized that early on. So I think those two things were what got me interested in the field. And then obviously, as I've gone through my career, you know, my specific interests have changed as we went down the different twists and turns that you do in research. And also as I've gotten older, right, it becomes a little bit more personal. But but that's how I got into the field, and I think, you know, one of the things that I've seen that is encouraging to me is, you know, when I started in the field, there were very, very few graduate students who went to graduate school to study aging. You know, they didn't, most people went to graduate school thinking they were going to do cancer biology or heart disease or neuroscience, right? Very, very few people went specifically with the intention of studying aging. That's changed. You actually now see quite a few graduate students as undergraduates identifying longevity, aging as an area of science that they want to specialize in, and intentionally choosing graduate programs that have good research in that area. And so I think that's been a paradigm shift a little bit in the field as it started to become more mainstream.
Whenever I went to the AGE conference last summer, that's one of the things that was kind of striking, as a lot of these guys are, you know, their 20s, and just hearing what they were working on. And, you know, one guy was working on an immunization for, you know, senescent cells. And
yeah.
Never thought about that. But it's like, these brilliant young people just going.
I say this all the time, and I totally believe it, which is why I keep saying it, which is that one of the things that that makes me most enthusiastic about this field is just how many just amazingly smart and put together young people are coming into the field. And again, we were talking about, we compare our sort of high school selves, right? Compared to where I was at that age, these kids, and again, to me, they're kids. I know they're not really kids, they're adults, but they are just so far ahead of where I was that it gives me a lot of optimism for the future.
Yeah, agreed.
So now we just need to see that shift happen in the medical field, right? So again, I think this is a question that I often, you know, think about is what needs to happen for MDs to start to recognize that there is a different way. And again, I'm totally generalizing, so if I'm offending any MDs, I apologize. But I think as a rule, right, medical training is still very much disease focused and reactive, right? And so what has to happen for this sort of paradigm shift, you know, what Peter Attia would call the shift from medicine 2.0 to medicine 3.0, what needs to happen for that to become the dominant paradigm in medical training? And we're a long ways away from that, I think. I'd love to believe that that's going to accelerate and happen quickly. It's very hard to imagine that happening quickly in the current healthcare structure.
Yeah, agreed. That's such a traditional thing that's been going on so long. And as you know, that, you know, the medical community just takes a long time to switch. I'm optimistic. I think it's coming because, like we talked about, young people being interested in that field. I've had young people come to me and, you know, who are medical students or, you know, interested in what they're going to go into, and they want to hang out with me and see what we're doing.
Yeah.
So there's some interest in that. And part of that has to do with just the information out there. Yeah. I think it's going to go at a snail's pace, though.
Yeah. Well, hopefully things like what we're doing right now, you know, like you said, the information out there, I think if you get credible voices out there talking about this, that people can relate to, hopefully that can have an impact. So I think, you know, that definitely is important, and hopefully this can contribute a little bit to that. I think, you know, still one of the things that's missing, we don't have, as far as I know, a continuing medical education course in longevity medicine or health span medicine, or, you know, so I think those kinds of things could also play a role in, if it can be done in a very rigorous way, in giving medical professionals the tools that they need to feel confident in adopting this sort of a approach to health.
Yeah. Expanding the education.
And no medical schools teach this kind of stuff yet. I think that'll change. I think we'll start to see the first early adopters in medical schools with, I don't know if it'll be a longevity medicine or health span medicine or, you know, something, start to bring that into the curriculum. So that would be something that, I mean, there's no reason it should have happened already, but hopefully we'll see that happen.
Yeah, it's not in the curriculum.
All right. Well, any of you medical deans who are out there listening. Okay, cool. Anything else you want to talk about? We've covered a lot of stuff.
No, it's good.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks for dropping by OptiSpan HQ today.
And Seattle was just right.
Yeah.
Right where I was going.
Yeah. It's kind of gray outside, so we'll have to get you some vitamin D.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny. I did forget that. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll get you taken care of. All right.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. You can follow us on Apple and Spotify, and please review us to let us know what you think. And come back every Tuesday for the next episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Daily Apple. This is part three of our discussion with Dr. Matthew Camberlin, and I hope you're enjoying this. I really enjoyed recording it and having this conversation. Thanks for listening. You can follow us on Apple and Spotify, and please review us to let us know what you think. Thanks.